From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Minnesota Democratic Senator Amy Klobuchar gave voters her presidential campaign pitch at a CNN town hall in Manchester, New Hampshire last night.
I am someone that comes from the heartland, a North Country state, a little similar to New Hampshire, but someone that has always believed that we have to govern from opportunity and not from the chaos that we're seeing right now in the White House.
Well, as you heard, Klobuchar is running as a heartland centrist, but perhaps that's out of step with her party's trajectory as it moves to the left, or the, quote, aspirational far left, as Klobuchar puts it. Consider that today, Senator Bernie Sanders announced that he's entering the 2020 presidential race. So how will that change the dynamic of the Democratic field? This hour on Point, a look at Amy Klobuchar's life story and career and the viability of heartland pragmatism in the National Democratic Party today. And you can join us. What do you want to know about Senator Amy Klobuchar? And what's your reaction to Senator Sanders jumping into the presidential race once again? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Well, first, let's start off today by talking a little bit more about Senator Sanders' announcement for his presidential campaign for the 2020 election. Joining us now is Elena Schneider, national political reporter at Politico. Elena, it's good to have you.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right. First of all, let's listen to a little bit of what Senator Sanders told CBS This Morning's John Dickerson about his presidential bid for 2020.
So, Senator Sanders, you're going to run for president.
I am going to run for president. That's correct.
What's going to be different this time?
We're going to win. We are going to also launch what I think is unprecedented in modern American history, and that is a grassroots movement, John, to lay the groundwork for transforming the economic and political life of this country.
That's Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders this morning on CBS This Morning. So, Elena Schneider, how does Senator Sanders' entrance to the 2020 field change the Democratic field, if at all?
Well, it changes it by bringing in one of the heavyweights into the primary field. So Bernie Sanders enters as one of the best-known candidates. Obviously, he ran in 2016 and built a 50-state organizing foundational structure from which he can now sort of push a go button and get that all going again. So he enters with some significant advantages over the rest of the field, many of whom are basically starting from scratch or very much in the early stages of building their presidential machine. He also comes in with a pretty massive small dollar donor base, which is going to be exceptionally important in this primary in terms of how you raise money, how you keep your operation then going. So he enters with a couple advantages, but obviously there are some significant disadvantages or differences from 2016. He also comes in as not the only person talking about populist policies, things that he really pushed for in 2016, made a part of the Democratic platform policy issues like Medicare for All, $15 minimum wage. He's certainly by far no longer the only person talking about those things. And somebody like Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren is another option in terms of sort of a more progressive option for Democrats to go for in this cycle.
Well, so I want to talk about that more in just a second here, but I'm still thinking about what he told John Dickerson this morning, that he's going to launch a campaign unprecedented in modern American history. But as you just said, Elena, it's his own 2016 campaign, which is the precedent here. So he does have that to his advantage. But as you were pointing out, the big changes is the things that he was talking about in 2016, which maybe centrist Democrats were not very enthusiastic to embrace. They're now, as you mentioned, part of, what many of his fellow Democrats who are in the race are running on. So does he need to differentiate himself at all? Or is his name recognition enough to sort of to carry him forward in the early stages of the campaign?
Well, I think you've put your finger on exactly what's going to be really fascinating and what we as political reporters are going to be watching really closely, which is what he's going to do different this cycle as opposed to last cycle. So as you said, these policies are now things that nearly all the senators who are running or have announced their runs have signed on to his single-payer bill in the Senate. And so it's going to be fascinating to watch in what ways he's going to try and run differently and maybe even push the party even further along that leftward lilt to try and pull everyone a little bit further from even where they were last cycle. And I think, though, what he is going to have to contend with are a couple of issues, though. He's first going to have to start by addressing or improve his standing with African-American voters. Mm-hmm. That's one block that he had some real issues with in 2016. And he's going to he's going to have to really deal with his sort of poor relationship with them at this point. And we're going to be watching very closely how he approaches voters in South Carolina. The organization that he builds up there is a way to try and heal that breach. And then on top of that is some really serious allegations about sexual harassment amongst staffers on his 2016 campaign. He's said clearly that he was concerned about that. He addressed that even in the CBS interview, talking about how maybe some of those staffers should have gotten rid of them sooner, and saying that they're going to be much more robust in terms of the way that they deal with it this cycle. But again, that's something that we're going to all be watching very closely.
Well, Elena, I wonder if there's also something else very fundamental about how the Democratic field is so dramatically different for the 2020 race than it was. I mean, there basically was no field in the 2016 race. And that is, we've already got an incredibly diverse field of candidates here. And one of our listeners is sending us this comment on Facebook saying, this is Carl Denham, who says, there are too many qualified candidates out there for the Democratic Party to have to settle for a straight white man. To do so would send the wrong signal to the nation and to the world. Is Carl on to something in terms of how some Democratic voters might be thinking?
In my conversations with voters out in Iowa and New Hampshire, obviously those who are going to sort of have the first voice and say into who's going to be the nominee, yes, there's a lot of people who are interested in supporting a woman candidate, supporting a person of color, saying it is time, we need to pick someone who is more reflective of the party and the voters who are part of the Democratic Party. Bernie Sanders, however, and I think he even addressed this earlier in the CBS interview too, was talking about how, you know, we shouldn't be judging candidates based on their age, which is a concern of his because he's heading into his 80s, on race, on gender, on sexual orientation, that we should be focused on what candidates are saying. And I think that that's sort of the way he's going to try and thread the needle in terms of sort of saying, look, I know I'm not maybe the most historic candidate in terms of his identity, but as somebody who was out front and first on so many of these issues, and therefore voters should trust him in terms of sort of being able to carry that banner forward.
Interesting. As Hillary Clinton might have changed or maybe put a little crack in the glass ceiling for women at the presidency, Bernie Sanders definitely put some cracks in the ceiling regarding policy. But the question is, has the party now left him behind? But let's go to some quick callers here if we can. Let's go to Logan, who's calling from Waterloo, Iowa. Logan, you're on the air. What do you think about Senator Sanders entering the race?
Well, thank you for taking my call. While I appreciate Bernie Sanders entering the race, I caucused for Sanders here in Iowa last cycle. But I think that it's time for someone else. I think that the party was so divided between Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders that he has burned some bridges unintentionally. But I just believe that there are so many candidates that have picked up the torches that he laid out for them, that we have a chance to make change with a female president, an African-American president, who knows. But I think that Sanders has done a great job changing the conversation, and I think he'll add to the conversation again.
Well, Logan, thank you so much for your call. Let's go to Corby, who's calling from Spring Hill, Florida. Corby, what do you think about Senator Sanders running for 2020?
I think it's a great thing, and thanks for having me on. We have to remember he was the person who pushed the Democratic Party to the left when the party itself was really resisting that push, even though polling would suggest that the people wanted those policies, like Medicare for all, free public college tuition, and the $15 minimum wage. Now you see all over the country, especially with Seattle and New York City and other cities like that, they're pushing these issues that Bernie put to the forefront. So I think almost out of respect, and because he has the base that I don't think anybody can match because he's been building it since 2016, he should and probably will win the Democratic nomination.
Oh, so you feel pretty confident about that, Corby. Okay, thank you so much for your call. Elena Schneider, though, I wonder, I've seen polling recently amongst Democrats as a whole that say that one of their greatest concerns regarding who their eventual nominee is electability, given who the person given the person that are likely to be running against, namely President Trump here. I mean, how does Sanders chalk up in terms of the electability question?
Well, I think you're right. The voters that I have talked to are nearly rabid about this need to pick somebody who's going to go up against the president. The question is, how do you define electability? And depending on the voter, that you get a different answer. And I think for Bernie supporters, they would say that, as you know, as your last caller just explained, that he was sort of the first person who was out there carrying the torch for these issues before anyone else was, really changed the party. And we saw this even in the 2018 House races, where we saw in these massive Democratic House primaries, a lot of those candidates opted to support Medicare for All because it sort of became a litmus test, and not in all places, but in definitely in some, including in California. And I think that that's something that at least his supporters really believe is going to be a key element to his positive electability. So somebody who is going to be out front on these issues, who's going to inspire people, who's going to be unapologetic in his sort of progressive push, that's something that they think was missing in 2016, mm-hmm. and therefore is going to be part of his electability pitch in 2020. I think that there's another segment of the Democratic electorate that would firmly disagree with that wouldn't push it too far to the left, and look at somebody like Amy Klobuchar, Minnesota senator who just announced last weekend, as somebody who might be giving a sort of more center-left option,
yeah.
and that she might be a better, more electable general election candidate.
Well, we've just got about 30 seconds before we take a break, and when we come back from the break, we will talk about Senator Amy Klobuchar and her candidacy and her career in depth here. So, Elena Schneider, stand by for just a moment. We will be talking about Senator Amy Klobuchar and more generally sort of where the Democratic Party is and how the Democratic presidential field is shaping up. Do you want to see it, if you're a Democratic primary voter, do you want it to move more toward the left? Or do you think a heartland pragmatist like Amy Klobuchar is more electable? We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're going to be spending the rest of this hour talking about Senator Amy Klobuchar's life story and her career and the viability of her brand of heartland pragmatism in the National Democratic Party today. And so let's listen to when she formally made her announcement for her candidacy for the presidency of the United States. Senator Klobuchar stood on a snow-covered stage in Boom Island Park, Minneapolis, on the 10th of February. And here's what she said.
I stand before you as the granddaughter of an iron ore miner, as the daughter of a teacher and a newspaper man, as the first woman elected to the United States Senate from the state of Minnesota, to announce my candidacy for president of the United States.
Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar a little earlier this month. I'm joined today by Elena Schneider. She's national political reporter for Politico. She's in Washington. And joining us now from St. Paul, Minnesota, is David Schultz, political science and law professor at Hamline University. We have a link to his recent article headlined Klobuchar for President. Her chances are less than most Minnesotans think. That link is at onpointradio.org. David Schultz, welcome to you.
Thank you for having me today.
Also with us from St. Paul as well is Patricia Lopez, editorial board member at the Minnesota Star Tribune. And before joining the editorial board, she covered Minnesota politics as a reporter and editor for more than 20 years. Patricia Lopez, welcome to you as well.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So, Patricia, let me just start with you. In the previous segment, we were talking about how Senator Bernie Sanders might be shaking up the Democratic field. From what you know of Amy Klobuchar and her career, how do you think she's looking on Senator Sanders entering the race as well?
Well, it's one more candidate who is at the farther left, maybe the farthest left end of the spectrum. And my guess is she's probably very comfortable with the lane that she has staked out for herself that people saw on the CNN town hall Monday night. And that is, you know, sort of this practical, you know, work for common ground. That has been her signature throughout her entire Senate career. She looks for what's gettable, not going to the extremes on either end. And right now she's kind of got that lane to herself.
Got it to herself. Okay, but David Schultz, you've written about how you think that what may work in Minnesota and has worked very well for Amy Klobuchar may not translate nationally. Why is that?
Well, there's a couple of reasons. First off, if we look at many of the candidates from Minnesota who tried to make the leap from Minnesota politics to the national stage, we of course know none of them have been successful in winning the presidency. And I know every state likes to think they're unique, you know, but the sort of consensus type of politics that has generally characterized Minnesota politics may not play well nationally in terms of you know, helping Klobuchar at this stage of the game. Additionally, you know, I think one of the things that Klobuchar has benefited from tremendously, of course, in Minnesota, right out from the bat, is a family name that was important in Minnesota. Mm-hmm. And I think one of her challenges, I think, running nationally is that unlike, let us say, an Elizabeth Warren, a Kamala Harris, even we'll say Bernie Sanders, they have bigger name recognition coming from larger media markets. And I think her challenge is to break through. Most recent, I think, Washington Post poll had her at about, 2% in terms of name identification.
Right.
So I think her challenge is how does she break out of the Midwest, which I know Minnesotans are going to hate when I say this, that, you know, we are, for many people, the flyover zone.
We have banned that phrase here at On Point, by
okay,
the way.
Okay, okay, good. Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah, but the point is that, you know, we come from a relatively smaller media market compared to the coasts, and how does she translate into being better known in those areas across the country.
All right. So, Elena Schneider, we're going to dig in with both David and Patricia more into Amy Klobuchar's sort of life story and her career as well. But give us the view of how Klobuchar's Minnesota grounding or Minnesota roots, could they possibly play to her advantage early in the primary cycle? Because, you know, Iowa right next door. But on the other hand, this time around, we have California moving its primary way up, and early voting in California is happening right around the time that the Iowa caucuses are going on. So how might that affect Klobuchar's candidacy early in the race?
Look, she's got a complicated path to win here, but there is one that exists. Granted, there's one that exists for maybe all 20 candidates, given how massive the field is. But look, there is a path for her, and it starts in Iowa. She's a neighboring senator. Iowa has frequently been kind to neighboring senators. They like people who talk like them, who sound like them, who are familiar with their issues. She certainly checks all of those boxes. And she also made a real statement by going to Wisconsin as her first presidential event, by sort of saying, look, I'm going to focus on those Midwestern values that, and those sort of quote unquote forgotten voices that with sort of an implicit shade thrown at Hillary Clinton along the way, saying we didn't pay attention to those people in 2016, and I'm going to pay attention to them this time going around. And I think that that may be something that appeals to voters in Iowa. And another thing that came out of the CNN town hall last night was this willingness to say no, was this willingness to sort of buck her party and sort of say, look, I'm going to be more straightforward with you about the policies that we're going to try and achieve. That sounds a little like Senator John McCain. It's a little bit more of a someone who's going to be independent from their party and pitch something that maybe is a little different. And look, New Hampshire loved Senator John McCain. But I think that whether or not that actually works is a very, very difficult strategy when you've got a number of really dynamic, fascinating characters with much bigger name IDs, national profiles. Obviously, mm-hmm. Kamala Harris has represented California for a number of years. She's got a huge early head start in a massive state like that, which is going to have a lot more power this go around. So look, it's possible, but it's definitely going to be a very complicated dance for her to get through it.
Okay, so let's turn now to talking a little bit more about, you know, Klobuchar herself, her life story and her career, because I think, you know, Elena, to your point about her current sort of name recognition challenge, absolutely true, but perhaps for many Americans, one of the first times that they realized that, you know, here's a senator from Minnesota, you know, on a national platform or national stage came during the confirmation hearings for now Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh, right? Because there was that very bracing moment when she questioned then Judge Kavanaugh about his drinking. So I just want to play those two moments here. This was back in September 2018, and she was really pushing Brett Kavanaugh about allegations regarding his drinking habits. It was a very tense exchange, and here it is.
There's never been a case where you drank so much that you didn't remember what happened the night before or part of what happened.
That's, you're asking about, yeah, blackout. I don't know. Have you?
Could you answer the question, Judge? I just, so you have, that's not happened. Is that your answer?
Yeah, and I'm curious if you have.
I have no drinking problem, Judge.
Yeah, nor do I.
Okay, so later on, then Judge Kavanaugh apologized to Senator Klobuchar, and we heard from Senator Klobuchar a little explanation about why she was able to very clearly say she has no drinking problem because someone in her family did.
My own dad struggled with alcoholism most of his life, and he got in trouble for it, and there were consequences. He is still in AA at age 90, and he's sober. And in his words, he was pursued by grace, and that's how he got through this.
Senator Amy Klobuchar at Brett Kavanaugh's Supreme Court confirmation hearings in September of last year. Patricia Lopez, this is obviously not a new story in Minnesota, but it was new to most of the rest of America. Can you tell us a little bit about how much Amy Klobuchar's father's struggle with alcoholism has shaped who she is?
Oh, I think to a great extent. It's something she's never made a secret of it. Jim Klobuchar was a columnist for our newspaper, the Star Tribune, and, you know, widely known, extremely popular. But his struggle was real and crippling at times. And of course, she bore the brunt of that the way any child of an alcoholic does. And I think one of the things it did was, you know, propel her to look for ways to improve things for people. And for her, that was making drunk driving a felony offense in Minnesota, which it was not before. And in a state where one out of eight people has some kind of drunk driving offense on their record, that's no small thing. And I think you've seen that, you know, that's why she asked that question specifically of Judge Kavanaugh about the blackout drinking. And as shocking as his comeback was, she took it, I think, in just the way you would expect her to. And like she knows this world. She knows the games, the manipulation. It's not going to make any impact on her. And she just doggedly pursued the answer. And I think that speaks a lot to her familiarity with all the damage that that condition can cause.
And David Schultz, I'm reading here from a 2006 Star Tribune profile of Senator Klobuchar when she was a Senate hopeful then. It said that she actually confronted her father about his alcoholism, you know, and as a prosecutor said, you know, I need to do something about this.
Yes, it's absolutely correct. And I think in part, her experience, you know, with her father's alcoholism shaped her in lots of different ways, not just in terms of what Patricia said here, in terms of any child would be, but I think in terms of her outlook in terms of being a prosecutor, because I think perhaps many of the listeners don't know that, you know, before she was a U.S. senator, she was county attorney, prosecutor, Hennepin County, which is the largest county in Minnesota where Minneapolis was. And she was exceedingly tough on the issue of drunk driving. But more expansive, I want to say here, is that she ran at a time for prosecutor back in the 90s where I think it was originally what, the New York Times that ran the headline, or was it your paper? I can't remember. Murderapolis. I can't remember what it was. At a time when
I think that was the New York Times.
I think it was the New York Times when the crime rates were soaring in Minnesota and nationwide. And she ran as a tough on crime prosecutor. Uh-huh. And it wasn't just drunk driving.
I did drug offenders and repeat offenders. Yeah,
also,
death on them.
Also, I was going to say sex offenders and guns too. And so I think one of her narratives is going to be the tough on crime, holding people responsible for their actions. But at the same time, she's going to run, I think, is at the same difficulty Senator Harris is running into right now. Because remember, Harris was also a prosecutor.
Right.
And some people are arguing that at the time she was a prosecutor, she was insensitive to, let's say, some of the racial implications of some of the prosecution. And there's no question that when Klobuchar was also a prosecutor, an awful lot of people of color went behind bars. And so at some point, I think her and Harris are going to have to, with the liberal base of the party and the people of color of her party, have to come to a reckoning with that.
Right. But you're talking about looking at their prosecutorial records of the 90s
exactly.
through 2019
exactly.
eyes. And, you
but
know,
that's
I,
what, but
I
that's what primary
know.
Voters do. I mean, yes. Hillary Clinton was questioned about the language that she used around so-called, quote-unquote, super predators in the
absolutely.
90s as well.
So, right. so they will need a good way to explain that. And you saw some of that from Klobuchar in the town hall when she talked about the fact that she had supported the first step criminal justice reforms that recently passed the Congress. And that now takes into account this, new view that liberals have about the racial impact of these prolonged sentences, particularly on nonviolent offenders. So, you know, she'll have to find a good way to explain it. But in the 1990s in Minneapolis, that's where the DFL party was. There was no question.
Yeah. I was going to say the same thing, that nationwide, again, this is the problem, as you brought up here, in terms of where Clinton was when she ran 3 years ago. And again, keep in mind, this is a time in the United States where we had soaring crime rates across the United States, and just about every prosecutor ran as tough on crime. We now look at it a generation later and look at some of the repercussions or implications of that. And whether it's good or bad to look at history in 2020 hindsight, I'll leave that to the historian. I'm a political scientist. But that's going to be one of the challenges that she faces.
Well, I mean, we could say 2019 eyes looking at the past, but it's also a matter of the record that she's running on. So I just want to play an ad that Senator Amy Klobuchar first ran in 2006 when she was running for the Senate in Minnesota. And she talks about her very record as a prosecutor.
My job is to hold people accountable when they break the law.
Amy Klobuchar. For 8 years, she's run a prosecutor's office.
We've gone after scam artists, child abusers, murderers. We even put a judge in prison. This is a judge who stole money from the bank account of a mentally disabled woman who he was supposed to protect. He was a Democrat, and so am I. But that didn't matter, because this guy had to go to jail. I believe in standing up for people without fear or favor. Isn't that what they should be doing in Washington? I'm Amy Klobuchar, and I approve this message.
That's an ad from 2006 when Senator Amy Klobuchar first ran for the Senate. Elena Schneider, jump in here. How much do you think Klobuchar's track record or history as a prosecutor will factor into how primary voters see her in this race?
I think it could be a part of how they see her. But look, I think that there's some much more glaring concerns that the liberal base is going to have about Amy Klobuchar before they even get to her prosecutorial record.
Yeah.
A lot of which we covered in the town hall, which was first when they asked about Medicare for All. She said that that was something to work towards, but that she would prefer something like a public option to start. She called the Green New Deal aspirational. And then when she was asked by a student, and again, remember, this town hall was held on a college campus. A student asked about whether or not she supported free four-year college at public universities, and she said flatly no.
So, Elena, hang on here, just because we have that a moment from that segment that you're talking about. Let's listen to more of what Amy Klobuchar had to say about free four-year college.
I am not for free four-year college for all. No. Thank you.
So, let me ask you this, because...
And I wish if I was a magic genie and could give that to everyone and we could afford it, I would. I'm just trying to find a mix of incentives and make sure kids that are in need, that's why I talked about expanding Pell Grants, can go to college and be able to afford it.
So, Elena Schneider, that's the moment there you're referring to. But the question is, as you were getting to, are Democratic primary voters, many of whom sent this wave of change to Congress in the 2018 midterms, are they ready to hear the Klobuchar message?
Well, I think some certainly are. And I think that that's why you heard sort of a smattering applause even after she said that, because I do think that there is an interest among some moderate Democrats to sort of not overpromise here, to not sort of go overboard in terms of the policies that somebody like Senator Bernie Sanders has really pushed for, that they think that, look, you need to also figure out a way to pay for those sorts of things. And so I think that there's certainly a segment of the Democratic electorate that's interested in what she has to say. The problem is that segment going to be too small compared to the potentially much larger group who are interested in sort of those bigger, bolder, progressive policies that somebody like Bernie Sanders is putting forward.
Patricia Lopez, we've got about 30 seconds before we have to take a quick break, but what's your thought on that?
You know, the issue is looking at what's doable. And Sanders' agenda is massive and it is inspirational. What are the realistic chances of getting all of those things through a divided Congress? You know, that's the calculation that Democratic voters are going to have to make in the primary.
Well, Patricia Lopez and David Schultz and Elena Schneider, stand by for just a moment. We're taking a look at Senator Amy Klobuchar's life story and career. She's one of the Democratic candidates for the 2020 presidential election. And we're asking, does the viability of her brand of heartland pragmatism or centrism really resonate in the National Democratic Party today and the direction it's headed? We'll be back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Seen. Listen and follow Last Seen wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are talking this hour about Senator Amy Klobuchar. She's the Minnesota Democrat who's running for president of the United States. We're talking about her life story and her career and whether or not the viability of her brand of heartland pragmatism, if it's viable, in the National Democratic Party today. I'm joined by Elena Schneider, David Schultz, and Patricia Lopez. And let's go straight to the phones. Let's go to Teresa, who's calling from Tampa, Florida. Teresa, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks so much for taking my call.
No problem. What do you think about Senator Klobuchar?
So I'm actually pretty excited about her. I'm 27 years old, gay, living in Tampa. I'm a lifelong Democrat, come from a Democratic family. And I'm getting concerned about the direction that the Democratic Party is headed. I appreciate all the social justice and the socially liberal policies, but I'm more interested in voting for somebody who can make promises that they can actually achieve and something that doesn't leave behind 50% of the country, because I feel like the Republicans have just gone so far to the right that I think we're making a mistake if we go equally in the extreme direction on the left. I think we're not going to be able to work with the rest of America, and we're going to be making a lot of promises that we can't uphold.
Right. Well, Teresa, thank you so much for your call. Let's go right to Rosalind, who's calling from New Orleans. And Rosalind, you just heard Teresa say she likes Senator Klobuchar because she's making promises that she could actually achieve if president. Rosalind, what do you think about that?
Hi, it's Rosalind, the flower.
Oh, sorry, Rosalind. My apologies. Yeah.
That's okay. I'm an 80-year-old black woman, and I can remember talking to FDR, listening to FDR on the radio when I was 6 years old. And he actually got us minimum wage. He tried to get us universal health care, didn't make it. It's time we got it. I mean, you know, like 74 years later, we still don't have universal health care. And I don't think that Amy's going to make it because the progressives are really working hard. Me too. That we need to look for our dreams and go for it. If you ask for 50 cents when you really want a dollar, you're going to get a quarter. Uh-huh. If you ask for $1.50 when you really want a dollar, you're more likely to get the dollar. And that's true. If you're going to be bargaining, you start out for asking for the moon and settle for whatever you can get. If you start out asking for a dime and you want a dollar, you're not even going to get the dime.
Right.
And that's part of her problem, is that she's not asking for enough. She's not demanding what this country needs. Do you realize that 100 people die every day for a lack of health care?
Mm. Well, Rosalind, thank you so much for your call. David Schultz, let me turn right to you on that. Absolutely fascinating what we hear in those two calls. I think it's like two aspects of the reality that the Democratic Party is facing. We first had Teresa saying, well, we can't put someone up as our nominee who may leave, in her words, 50% of the country behind and making undeliverable promises. But Rosalind, on the other hand, part of the progressive wing who says, no, now is the time to think big. And that, in fact, maybe perhaps mirroring the big thinking, you know, that she's seeing having been effective on the right for Republicans. What do you make of that? And where does that put Amy Klobuchar?
Well, it's an interesting challenge because we clearly know that the Democrats are motivated to defeat Donald Trump. But simply for the next presidential cycle of being against Donald Trump is not going to be enough. Clearly, Klobuchar is also. But what we're still seeing within the party is, I want to say, this Clinton-Sanders divide that's still there. You know, in many ways, Amy Klobuchar is a Clinton type of Democrat, a more kind of a moderate, and if I say this, kind of a tinker with the system kind of approach, which may be a very realistic approach but in terms of how you move the political system. But in terms of it being a grand, let's say, exciting narrative, it's not moving, I think, where the base of the Democratic Party is right now. I was thinking about this about a week or so ago. I think, what was it, a piece by George Will in the Washington
right.
Post saying that Klobuchar is perhaps the kind of Democrat that can get Republican votes. Sort of two observations. One, I'm not sure what the liberal wing of the Democratic Party saying you have George Will's endorsement helps you. And then two, I think there is an exaggeration in terms of believing that we're going to move very many Republicans over to the Democratic side. I know Klobuchar did well in Minnesota winning counties that Trump did, but I think nationwide the idea of running as a centrist moderate and you're going to bring Republicans over, the data doesn't support that.
Well, Patricia Lopez, what about those voters who are the quote-unquote soft supporters of President Trump? I mean, David Frum, that's what he wrote in the Atlantic about how Democrats could possibly retake the White House. Maybe possibly the folks who voted for Barack Obama, but then Donald Trump, not necessarily, you know, card-carrying Republicans, mm-hmm. but persuadable.
Well, you know, I don't think there's any question that there will be a lot of disaffected Republicans come 2020, especially, you know, as they start filing their tax returns and finding out that the tax cut didn't work out quite the way they wanted it to. So, you know, that is there for the right kind of candidate. Can Klobuchar, you know, build a coalition out of that?
Mm-hmm.
You know, as David points out, the data doesn't really support it. The momentum, the activity, the tendency lately has been to try to turn out all of your voters and not worry about trying to appeal to the other side. So she'd be running counter to that. On the other hand, you know, Trump is such an extraordinarily polarizing figure. There may be a fair number of voters who are just tired of the drama.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Tired of the large personalities, tired of the promises. And, you know, if they're looking for a candidate, I think, you know, Klobuchar is probably banking on the fact that they're looking for somebody who is more practical. I just don't know whether, you know, you can survive the primary
exactly.
process. It's a great general election
yeah.
strategy. But can you survive the primary with a strategy like that?
I think that's a key question. Go ahead, David.
You know, I was going to say, and I think Elena brought this up earlier, too, is that, you know, getting through the primaries, as Patricia saying, especially now with the changing formula with California coming early mm-hmm. and some really big states coming very early at this point, the road through Iowa is going to be difficult. I know a few years ago, our Governor Tim Pawlenty, Michelle Bachmann, Congresswoman, kind of banked on the idea of saying, well, we're in Minnesota, we'll go down to Iowa, and of course we'll be, you know, we'll be viewed really nicely as Midwesterners and have name recognition. That didn't play well here. And so I'm a little skeptical. Not impossible, but the thread has to be, you know, scoring big in Iowa and somehow hoping that gives you the momentum to now kick you into what, New Hampshire. But with Sanders, you know, now declaring, and I think if I remember correctly, 3 years ago, Sanders won pretty big in New Hampshire. I think it makes the Iowa strategy a little bit more complicated
yeah.
than we had before.
Well, let's go back to the calls. Let's go to Alex, who's calling from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Alex, you're on the air.
Hi. I think that Klobuchar's strategy is all wrong. You know, I don't think that it's something that's really going to win anything. I mean, people are talking about, you know, like, well, what if you just do this? Or what if you're doing that? I mean, we've already done that in 2016. I mean, there's just her idea that, like, colleges aren't affordable. 20 different states have now introduced affordable college. You know, and I think that if you run a Republican against a Republican, the Republican is always going to win. And, yeah, if you are starting, like, if you say you're a pragmatist or whatever, mm-hmm. it just means that you're not really trying. And if you come to the table with already a compromise, you're going to get less than that.
Right. Well, Alex, thank you for your call. Elena Schneider, this is so interesting to me because one of the things that people look upon Amy Klobuchar's Senate career with admiration is her tendency to try to cross the aisle, right, to reach out to Republicans for policy proposals and bills that she's championed over the many years. But as we're hearing in the voices of these Democratic callers calling in, that is not a tendency that they want to see in the nominee that they put forward for the White House.
I think that running as a consensus builder in a time like this when we are so incredibly polarized is certainly a difficult strategy to pull off. But to go back to sort of the theory of the case that I think her team sort of imagines is the possibility that there's going to be so many people divvying up the pool of primary voters who want a more progressive candidate. You've got Kamala Harris, Cory Booker, Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, Kirsten Gillibrand, Tulsi Gabbard. I mean, Joaquin Castro. It just keeps going on and on and on. And so I think that the hope is that if all those candidates divide up the pool of liberal progressive voters, that leaves open maybe a slim one, but a lane that Amy Klobuchar can sit in alone, where she talks more about being a pragmatist, and that is appealing to some of those voters, and then take that bounce out of Iowa to go from there. Mm. Look, again, I agree that that's an incredibly slim and very difficult strategy to sort of hang your hat on, but I do think that in an environment where we've got just so many people running, there is that possibility. But look, like you said, being a consensus builder, being somebody who's very familiar with Republicans. And in fact, Politico wrote, my great Senate colleague wrote a story about how Amy Klobuchar is a favorite amongst Republican senators, that several of them went on the record even acknowledging, well, maybe this isn't going to help her all that much, but we really like Amy. And we like the way that she has done things and conducted herself and worked across the aisle. And so I think that that's something that, you know, look, it's a double-edged sword in a primary electorate.
Yeah. Well, Patricia Lopez, I was really fascinated with the insight that you and David were giving about Amy Klobuchar's career in Minnesota itself. And I want to turn back to that for a moment because we have a comment that's come in on Facebook from Tess Dornfeld, who says, anyone who's thinking about supporting Klobuchar needs to understand her actions in northeastern Minnesota first. Even if you don't care about any of those things, you should care that she puts political expediency ahead of morals. Now, Tess doesn't elaborate on what she's talking about here, but Patricia, do you might know what Tess Dornfeld is referring to?
You know, I'm actually not sure. Puts it ahead of morals. I'd love to have a little bit more to go on there.
Yeah, she doesn't say it. But David, go ahead.
This is pure speculation. Just pure speculation. It could either be what? Could it be on a reproductive rights issue or something? Depending
in
where
northeastern Minnesota, well, particularly.
Well, I was going to say northeastern would be probably more likely to be pro-life up there. I'm guessing, and which means because Klobuchar is pro-choice, and so I'm speculating. I don't know. The only other issue that's going on there, I don't know where she stands on. There's a big issue in Minnesota, an area called the Iron Range, which is all about trying to bring back some mining in there. And I'm just wondering if that's what it is. I don't know.
She's done well on the Iron Range,
yeah,
though.
I
think, you know, if purity tests are going to be applied, she's probably going to fail because she is not and never has been one of those, you know, litmus test kind of candidates. She kind of shies away from the extremes on both ends. So political expediency, you know, if you wanted to, of course, every politician makes their compromises. She was a strong supporter of the Affordable Care Act, mm-hmm. and continues to be. But one of the initial pieces that was supposed to fund it was the medical devices tax. Mm-hmm. And that's where she was confronted with a real choice, that's a huge industry in this state. And there was intense pressure from that industry to back off of that tax. She joined with a Republican, Eric Paulson, to push for the repeal of that tax that, you know, was supposed to provide the underlying funding for the act. So those are the kind of choices that many, many politicians have to make. That's one choice that she made. She's now talking about charging the pharmaceutical industries to help pay for money that would provide for opioid and addiction treatment. You know, similar kind of choice that a president would have to make. You're going to cross a lot of enemies if you try to take on big pharma.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's where the expediency comes in.
Mm. Well, let's play a moment from last night's CNN town hall in Manchester, New Hampshire, again, because as you all know, there has been some controversy over allegations of how Senator Klobuchar manages her staff and how she treats her staff. And a Manchester voter asked her about that last night. And here's what Senator Klobuchar said.
Am I a tough boss? Sometimes, yes. Have I pushed people too hard? Yes. But I have kept expectations for myself that are very high. I've asked my staff to meet those same expectations. And that, the big point for me, is I want the country to meet high expectations. Because we don't have that going now.
Senator Amy Klobuchar last night in New Hampshire. Patricia Lopez, we've had some reporting about, you know, what folks are saying about how she treats her staff in Washington. But is this aspect of who she is that something that's been an issue or been in Minnesotans' minds and before she ever made it to D.C.?
It's, you know, it's surfaced from time to time. In fact, I did a story in her first Senate run about similar complaints from the prosecutor's office. And there were some prosecutors who complained that they weren't treated well, you know, other issues. It threatened her endorsement from a union for a while. So those things have kind of persisted. I think the way she answered it was probably the smartest way you could answer it, is not to shy away from who you are. I mean, she is a legendarily demanding person who drives herself harder, I think, than anyone else, and has acknowledged that she drives her staff as well. Is it too hard? I think, you know, for this to really stick, you're going to have to see people with their names attached coming out in public with specific complaints.
Mm-hmm.
And it's important to remember that she is potentially, as a nominee, would be up against a boss who regularly, publicly humiliates the people who
right.
work for him. So in another election cycle, this could have been much more damaging. You know, up against somebody like Donald Trump, it still has the potential
right.
to hurt, but it depends, I think, on how she handles it and what other information comes out, if any.
Well, Elena Schneider, one interesting thing I've noticed about how Senator Klobuchar has been handling this thus far is that she's not apologizing, right? She's not saying, I'm so sorry if I hurt people, et cetera, et cetera. She's saying, yes, I am tough. Is that working for her?
Well, I think that it goes to sort of the image that she's trying to craft for herself, which is one of grit and toughness and somebody who can stand up to Donald Trump. So I think in the larger image of the kind of candidate she wants to build for herself, that sort of potentially could be helpful in terms of feeding that. But it also runs sort of contrary to the public profile that she has largely presented to herself up to this point, which is much more of sort of a Minnesota nice, cool-headed, level-headed person who wants to work across the aisle. So I think that it is these reports that came out, like Patricia said, were anonymous former aides who unloaded a lot of criticisms on the senator. It's been an open secret that she's one of the toughest bosses to work for in Washington. And certainly sexism
yeah.
is something that her defenders would say plays a large role in all of this. But I think it is something that that if these stories continue to trickle out, that's where the issue could come from.
Well, David Schultz, we've got 30 seconds left here, but I do want to hear one last word from you. Is there something about Senator Klobuchar that you think people don't know but should?
What they probably should know about her is, again, it's the tenacity. It's the tenacity in terms of her running, and I think it's also the idea of saying that she really does believe that you can reach across the aisles mm-hmm. and really can forge compromise. Again, whether or not that is a realistic belief in today's political environment, I'll leave that to others to think about.
Well, David Schultz, political science and law professor at Hamline University, thank you so much. And Patricia Lopez, editorial board member at the Star Tribune, thank you to Well. And Elena Schneider, national political reporter for Politico. It was great to have all of you this hour. Thank you so much. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point. Mm-hmm.